Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Herb Morielli, top innovating chairman, CEO, and CTO who's sharing his best practices. Herb, thank you for coming in today and sharing so many of your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thanks, Stephen. I really appreciate the work you do, and I'm happy to be here talking to you today.
Now, Herb, can you describe your journey from a very young age to your 20s and the milestones of valuable lessons that continue to shape your vision, goals, and execution style?
Yes, you know, I think as someone coming up in the area of software in the early 80s, I would say that a lot of my experiences are much like others. I played with Legos, like lots of kids, and I think the process of building things, tearing them down, trying to do them differently, happened at an early age. I also was one of those kids that decided they had to have one of the early computers, home computers, and so I saved up my money through Christmas and that kind of a thing in middle schools, and I ended up going out and buying a TRS-80 with a little help from my dad in the end. And began the journey down programming. Eventually, that then grew to another infamous early computer, the PC Junior. And it was almost like having a car for me at that point where, people kind of get into their cars and then upgrade it and find new ways to improve performance, the teenagers. For me, it was the PC Junior. It was putting in extra memory, putting on a disk drive, and I must have had one of the nicer PC juniors in the country. And my journey with programming continued. And ultimately, that led me to the University of Colorado, where I studied computer science and went further. Along that time at CU, I had the opportunity to serve as the president of the ACM local student chapter. And I think that was the first time that I had stepped into any kind of leadership role, and bringing people together, looking for ways to get access to technology, leaders that were doing things that otherwise we wouldn't have had access to if we weren't the ACM chapter. And I remember visiting Cray Computer. That was certainly a very impactful time for me, going to digital and talking to product managers, a number of different points of access, and that opened my mind to thinking beyond just the programming. The other thing that I think shaped a lot of the things that happened later was that I had a professor who was always looking for innovation, new ways to get students involved, and her name was Ebby Nemeth, and she took students to the USENIX conference, and USENIX is really where the world's leading thinkers on Unix were coming together, as well as the Internet. A lot of the early, like UUNET, was involved, and so I was hearing about the Internet and really the commercialization of the Internet at that time. We're talking about the 1990 time frame. So as I started to see a bigger picture and also getting people involved and especially young folks to things that were coming down the pipe, that was very inspiring. And also the connections made, meeting people that were doing things that I had heard about and I was just, awed by getting to meet them. It made it much more practical for me and gave me the idea that maybe I could do this kind of thing. Probably the thing that then led to who I am today and began to form me, if you will, is I started a company my last year at University of Colorado with a fantastic guy, Trent Hine. And we really just kind of backed into this thing. People were asking Trent, who is extremely technical and had been around a while, to help if he could help their businesses connect to the Internet. This is now 1991, so we're connecting with modems primarily to just move email. And so we saw an opportunity to just make a company, print some business cards, and see what we could do, because we weren't really sure what we were going to end up doing as a career once we graduated. That turned out to be one of those classical stories of students in college that go on to build a company. And we actually started as two people and eventually grew that to over 500 people. And that's from age 22 to around 30. And when you do that kind of thing, you are pretty much doing it all in business. I went from coding to doing system administration, network administration, hiring people, ultimately selling the company, building partnerships, you know, all the different aspects of building a business. And that happened at a early age. The timing was great with the emergence of the internet. We did everything from building websites, but also really just connecting people, managing networks, and some of the more technical aspects of that. So by the time I was 30, and you think about that journey, a lot had happened, and that made me uniquely well-rounded at an earlier age, and has kind of driven me to think, well, what else can be done in the area of entrepreneurship to build companies, to look at emerging technologies, and how far you can take that kind of thing?
So that's a really interesting story. So you did an exit. Were you acquired, or how did that happen?
We had a unique exit. We actually connected with an investor out of Chicago who was looking to do a roll-up. And so their initial thinking was to roll up Cisco resellers. And we had been doing some reselling as part of our business of Cisco. However, that really wasn't our core business. So we had bumped into them, and we had a lot of other companies expressing interest in us. We are also at a point where we had bootstrapped that company for 8 years, and just from starting to, you know, our graduation money, we bought a computer and just built from that. So there was nothing paid into this company. We built it up, and there was a lot going on there in the late 90s. So we were beginning to think maybe we need to raise some money. So the investor out of Chicago had the idea of doing the roll-up, but they needed one company to build from, and that ended up being us. So we had the cash available at that point to then go out and do some acquisitions, and also with that brought in a CEO who was going to ultimately lead the roll-up, which at that time I was very comfortable with because, you know, I was a young person. We were getting to be quite big, and I thought, you know, what a great time to bring in somebody with significant leadership. So we ended up having capital to work with, a CEO who could lead us towards an IPO, which was obviously the investor's ultimate goal. And so through that, we ended up with a good exit because the initial company was acquired, and we were also participating in the build-out of the new company, which sadly didn't end up playing out how everybody would like. I think the market conditions certainly changed for the final time in November of 2000. So, you know, things just turned out a little differently than we'd like in the end. But it did set me up at that point as a founder to begin to think about doing other things. So for that, I'm very fortunate.
Well, you learned some great lessons from that. Now, you know, going on from there, what are some valuable enterprise tips that you can share from your experiences with Six Kites?
Yeah, Six Kites is my latest journey. And when I look at the enterprise today and what's going on, I think the ability to cut through the hype is and find the fit for emerging technologies within your business. That is very hard these days because there's so much going on, and a lot of things are coming up, the Gartner hype cycle, and it's great stuff for press and research. But when you're leading an enterprise, ultimately what you're trying to do is accomplish corporate goals. And aligning something that is emerging with the goals of the company, especially when you're hearing so much about the probability or the possibility of this technology, can be kind of hard. And I think finding that thread that connects from the specific company right now objectives to how can this technology move that needle is very important. Now, sometimes in some enterprises, you can get kind of far out. You can look at something as R&D, and you can invest in the emerging technologies, make sure you are coming up to speed and learning, but and leave out what is the ROI to a little bit later time because it's more investigative. But I think many companies benefit by connecting from what's happening today at the technology to how can it move the needle over the next 6 months to 12 months. And that keeps the whole thing more practical because you have to get away from the hype and you have to get into what really is happening with this and what's possible today. And it creates a real balanced conversation between the non-technical executive team and the technologists within the company.
So can you talk more about Six Kites and you know, what do you hope to achieve?
Six Kites is an interesting company in that when I started this company, I decided to go back to the very basics and bootstrap it. And so there was never an intention to in any way raise money for the company, and that is still the case today. So as such, when you start out and you're trying to find one way or another to get a customer, you go to your network. And so in the beginning, I, over time, built a large network, and I'd been doing some work in the area of social media and also within the social enterprise, so the use of social technologies to drive collaboration internally. And I knew that could be a bit of a beachhead, so I went out and I spoke to my network and found some great customers and some consulting projects. That was in the area of social media. Part of my heart is in the area of software development. And at the time, mobile apps in particular were really just beginning to emerge. This is 2009. And obviously there had been mobile apps around, but we're at that point where it's pretty clear businesses were going to need some help with mobile apps and, in general, good software. So I saw that we were going to move from social media into application development, and that happened. So today, we now have three areas of the business. We have a new one, but I'll get to in a second. But you have this company which is doing social media professional services at the same time as doing, very sophisticated, significant software development. The third area, which is new, is the area called platforms, where we have partnered with multiple market leaders to become experts on their platforms for the purposes of integration and configuration and professional services around that. So we've gone from this company, which was built primarily just on relationships and wherever they may take us, and software development, and having this really broad kind of approach into starting now at this phase in time to focus in on a strategy which is much more about the platforms. And I think looking ahead, the platforms that are available to the organizations to build out whatever innovative technology they're taking on, that those platforms are powering that movement. And to master those platforms and, in a very important way, connect those to this huge ecosystem out there of APIs. Because obviously platforms are only capable of what they do at the core. But what takes it to the whole next level for them is to be able to connect those systems into the myriad of other systems within the enterprise or outside the enterprise to make that application and that platform base go to the next level. So looking ahead for our business, I continue to see the professional services because a lot of companies don't know how to sort through some of the emerging technologies and find that strategy that I referenced earlier on, but also to take the platform companies who have their core feature set but can offer their customers
much more once it begins to connect into, you know, large other systems and pull data and move data back and forth.
So what do you hope to do then eventually? Do an exit again, as in the past, or get acquired, or at some point?
I have no plans for an exit for the company. I really do try to wake up every day and say, what can we do extremely well? What are we passionate about? And how are we measuring that? And I believe that if you continue to do that, you end up having something of value, and that value can be ultimately monetized in a couple different ways. You can either pour back into the business. You can, you know, begin to throw off profit for both for the employees and owners, or you begin to create enough value that somebody says, boy, this is essential to our business in terms of acquisition. And maybe you're at a time and place in the evolution of the business that's an attractive option. So I sometimes advise entrepreneurs to make sure you always have an exit strategy. And other times I'll say, make sure your company is always for sale, because that creates the mentality of what value are we ultimately creating and how are we going to be able to take advantage of that over time. But as an entrepreneur at this point in my life, and this point in the business, I'm really not thinking about what's going to happen down the road. If I wake up every day and people that I work with wake up every day and they enjoy what they're doing and they're challenged by the work and we're proud of what we're doing, that can be absolutely enough for now. And as time goes by, you know, we'll see what the right thing to do is.
You know, you've had a number of different roles in your career, and you've been quite successful. So what are your top tips from those prior roles?
I think because of my background being so varied, I often find it challenging to answer that question. I think the obvious piece of this is that there are always people involved when you're trying to get something done. And so leadership is a key part of this. And leadership, I often think of leadership like astronomy. It's just so deep and so complicated that I often wonder whether I could ever get my head around it. And as I've tried to learn more about leadership and be a leader and take teams to, you know, new heights, I'm often finding that it's very, very hard. But it's in that, when you get the right team, the chemistry is right, and the way that you're doing things adds up. To me, that's what crosses both CEO and CTO and really various other things I've done outside of those roles, is getting people behind an idea, or maybe a better way to say that would be is getting people behind their own idea and, in a way, taking the tip of the spear that's already moving and pushing it through things. So leadership is absolutely been one of the deeper and more challenging aspects of the journey. I'm coming to understand more looking back, and I think the experiences I'm having more recently, is that a deep knowledge of the area that you're working is quite important. I know that there are many people in business that are able to make a big impact and create a great deal of success because they understand the dynamics of building an organization, running it, executing it, but maybe don't really need to be deep in the actual product or how that product is brought to market. For me, maybe it's that the businesses, in terms of the phases they've been at that I've been involved with, the more you understand really the nitty-gritty, then when you're leading, whether it be with the team or speaking to customers, whatever it might be, you have a better appreciation of the complexity of the situation, so that you can talk to people and bridge often the gap between what the company produces and the details around that and the audiences around it who, you know, go from buying the product or coming on board and making decisions, anything from finance, et cetera. Often you have to connect the dots. And I think the deeper you are in understanding it, the better you can do that. At least that's what's made a difference for me. So that's been one of the lessons learned. I think when I was least effective at times, I thought I knew what was going on. And I think probably I didn't. And both that made it challenging to do the role of leadership, but also I looked at the team that was more on the ground with their hands in things, and I think they began to believe that I wasn't necessarily familiar enough with the specifics in order to be making the decisions I was making. And so I began to feel that dynamic building, and that was one of the things that drove me to say, hey, I really need to be much more involved in what we're doing so that I can be a better translator of that. So those are a couple things that come to mind today. I think if you asked me this question 5 years ago, I would have had some other perspective, and 3 years before that, another. It's definitely quite a journey when you're doing a number of different businesses and in different domains. Each one of those often like children. As you start a business, you go, wow, I thought I had this figured out. And then you get another kid, and you're like, wow, they're totally different. And that's what business has been like for me, whether it be the technology itself or just really the leadership role. It's each one's been unique.
Now, we're going to switch a bit here. Can you describe Topplers and then the Domino Awards?
Yes. Topplers and Domino Award are one of the things that I'm probably most proud of. What happened was after I had sold and exited Exor, that first company that we discussed, I wanted to find a way to get more involved with the University of Colorado and give back. I've always thought it was important to remember where you came from. And through a little bit of encouragement of my dad to always keep that in mind, too. So my dad's been a major influence in my life. And out of that, I came up with an idea called the Domino Award. And so I approached one of the who was actually the chair of the computer science department at the time, Clayton Lewis, and I said, what about a program for the students where they write an essay that honors the work of notable technologists and how that added up, like a series of dominoes tipping over and drawing all of the pieces where that led to this, that led to this, and talking about each one of those technologies along the way and how that then has created an impact, a meaningful impact on the world. So we got behind that idea, and that started in 2002. The one thing that we wanted to make sure was unique about the Domino Award is that we would have an experience for the students that ended up getting selected for having the best essay. And that experience started by going to the Telluride Technology Festival, or the Tech Fest. And I began to bring students to Telluride. And through that, I could see that they were having an experience much like I had when I went to the USENIX conference. And they began to see a broader perspective on technology. And sometimes it was physics. I mean, it didn't have to necessarily do specifically with computing. But they did also get to meet very notable people along the way. I can remember one time, one of the winners meeting Tim Berners-Lee. I remember one time the students getting to meet Neil Armstrong. So both that was fun for me, but it began to create a bit of a different kind of idea for the Domino Award. And so that went on for a few years, and after a while we realized, why don't we take this a little bigger? What if this program that was started to you just as something for me to do and get back into the computer science department which I came, and my wife came out of that same program, and my business partner, and several friends, and say, hey, maybe there's something we can do where we take the Domino Award out to anybody in computer science, specifically undergrads, is how that played out. and have them write an essay. One of the pieces within the Domino War that is important is the essay is supposed to be up to or around, we're not very strict, but 500 words. Why that's important is it's something you can knock out in a day. And following the domino analogy, it all starts with a little flick of the domino and things add up. And as I've interviewed the Domino Award winners over the years, I hear a consistent theme that, boy, this was very interesting for me to do. It didn't take a lot of work. And holy cow, how does this add it up? And here am I doing this experience and connecting with other Domino Award winners. And it is a small thing. So today, the Domino Award operates under a nonprofit that I started called Topplers. Topplers is all based on little things adding up, and we have different programs that we run within Topplers, and now one of them is the Domino Award. And it's available, I think there are somewhere between 40,000 to 45,000 different students, undergrad students, in computer science these days, which is absolutely fantastic. And we make it available to all of them. We do a little bit of marketing to the various different colleges and universities that have those programs. And through that and some social media, the word gets out and people find the website, they write their essay, submit it, and then we evaluate those essays through both the previous Domino Award winners as a way for them to get back. Also faculty from multiple universities. We will bring people in from industry. They see it as a volunteering opportunity. And so they'll read the essays, and of course, I'm lucky enough to get to read them all myself as well. And we just go through a stack ranking of everybody's different evaluations and then select the winners.
You know, it's a fascinating program for enabling and empowering young people into computing and technology itself. What are your sort of dreams for the Domino Awards, you know, let's say into the future?
You know, looking ahead, thinking through from my own perspective of things adding up, I'm always trying to, it's not necessarily make it bigger and better. It's about that impact that's happening from that small thing kind of cascading down. And some of the things that are out there that we're reaching towards, or I believe things are kind of tipping forward towards, are increased participation. You know, when you have something that started just at one school and now is available to obviously all computer science students now, the more people participate, the more we have students thinking about the beginnings of computer science and technology and all the different ways that, you know, depending on how far back you go. I mean, we actually have had some essays that go back to the blankets and clothing and drawing a conclusion from that all the way through computer science. So the more we have people participating, the more we're creating space for students to think beyond the bits and bytes and now into how that will add up. So that's one area I'd like to see continue to grow. Another is that the experiences themselves for the winners, there is so much possibility there. There's so much great stuff happening in the area of technology. It's just, you know, it's fascinating. So to offer more experiences, continuing to provide access into really the most innovative, high-impact kind of things, then they see that as, wow, this is one of those things that's adding up. What does that mean for me? So I'd like to continue to expand the experiences. The other thing is we've been fortunate and I think surprised in a way by the demographics of participation in the award. We have, relative to the population of females in computer science programs, we've had a highly disproportionate level of participation and also the winners. And I think that reflects that different kinds of students participate in this award because they're thinking in a different way about technology. And it's particularly evident in girls coming up through high school now more and more, and into computer science programs, and I think the impact being made in industry or in research, that diversity of thinking allows there to be a more holistic view of all the amazing innovations happening and how it's added up. So maintaining the diversity and participation of the program is a large part of that. And frankly, I think the last piece I'd say is that this has the potential to be a very unique and prestigious opportunity for students. So it's not just about the participation in this kind of thing. It's an award. And there are certainly other awards out there for undergrads, but they're different than the Domino Award. And so in terms of how the program is executed, its reach, its impact, and not just during the experience, but afterwards, the connecting the people that have both participated and won, raising the profile of this, I believe, opens up doors that then create more fuel and energy behind it, and then it can continue to grow and make a large impact.
Now, maybe you could just describe two cool things that students do as a result of the awards and be very specific.
It's easy to be specific because I just had experience with the latest two winners just a week ago. We went to the South by Southwest Interactive Festival. Now, to put this in perspective, a couple things. One, I've never met the winners yet because they come from different schools. So we show up and get on airplanes and meet up. And South by Southwest Interactive is in Austin, Texas. And it is notorious for a place where bringing together a lot of thinkers, emerging technology, and, ranging from discussions about living a life of happiness to the deepest technical stuff, doing DNA experiments in your garage with kits, and of course then into the area of like software, Internet of Things, virtual reality, etc. So when we got to South by Southwest, we had access to pretty much anything that the students wanted to explore. And I always tell them, this is your time. I'll follow you where you want to go. Look at the program. And this year, there was a heavy focus on entrepreneurship. All through that, we ended up at the TechStars program, which is an accelerator that I have some affiliation with. And this is the specific part. We were able to have audience with only approximately 20 others with the CTO of Amazon. What was fascinating about that conversation is he walked through the history and the evolution of the Amazon platform. And I can tell you, having heard a number of presentations over the years, none had ever discussed in such detail all the aspects that go into large-scale architecture. So, they're sitting there writing notes and kind of front row looking at this guy going, oh my gosh, this is the CTO of one of the largest technology footprints in the world. And that was one specific. Another specific one actually goes back to an experience with Sean Parker. So Sean Parker was one of the two Seans of Napster, and then later went on and became a bit notorious for his involvement in Facebook, and actually is in the movie about Facebook, et cetera. And certainly within the technology industry, the emerging kind of entrepreneurial space, and within the Silicon Valley, Sean's well known. And he had come to Telluride when I was going back to Telluride shortly after being on the cover of Time magazine and the whole thing that played out with Napster, which ultimately ended up shutting down Napster. And to be able to have a conversation with a guy who was, I want to say at the time, maybe he was 20 years old, who had been at this almost celebrity status, actually celebrity status, and then to have that all change and sitting there thinking, what is next and what did I learn from that? And being able to have a conversation at my home, sitting up all night and talk to somebody that was, you know, changing the way digital rights worked on the internet at a very young age and was now at a place where, boy, there wasn't a lot to show for that. Other than the technology, it wasn't like he got rich on Napster. And having a conversation of what that was really unique. I mean, it was a all-night conversation.
Now, you talked about being part of TechStars in some way. Can you share some valuable tips from your work with TechStars and as a mentor?
Yeah, TechStars is an amazing organization, especially for first-time entrepreneurs, but also even others that have, you know, had success and built companies or maybe had to shut them down and they're at that early phase. So to explain TechStars, companies propose their idea to get into the TechStars program. And they're selected, a handful of them. In the program I'm currently involved with in Boulder, I want to say there's maybe 10 or 12. And the number of entries are well into the hundreds. And this is just the Boulder program. And so they're evaluated and they're brought in to then be accelerated. And they get a very small amount of money. But what they're working towards is getting the next chunk of money from TechStars, which is more in the neighborhood of $100,000. So, it's, you know, if you have a team of three or four, it's not a lot. But it sets you on the path towards going then and raising more money, but also probably most importantly, formulating and tightening up your business idea. So there's a great deal of mentorship and access to resources and education, and everybody's thrown into that program. It's extremely intensive, and it's 12 weeks long, and it culminates in one night where they're all their pitch day, if you will, and they all get up on stage and they give their pitch, and that sets them up for raising money if they're going to go do that, or moving on to executing their business if they don't need to raise that money. So that's how it works. And as a mentor within that program, there's one basic principle, and it's give first. And it focuses the thinking on how can we make an impact as mentors, give of ourselves in ways that then they can absorb. And I think that's really, you know, fundamental to mentorship in, you know, at its core. However, when you're sitting down with an organization who is entering a 12-week program, usually with, you know, with a pretty early idea, the dynamics that team is going through and the areas that they need help and maybe completely changing their business idea over 12 weeks, and you're there to give first, it's interesting because sometimes they have no idea what they need. They're moving so quickly. They're so consumed in the program that I've found it often hard to say, well, how can I give here? And then when you find it, by the time you meet with them 1 week later to maybe do a deep dive on their roadmap, they've already moved into some new direction. So watching how raw the businesses are when they come in, even though maybe they think they're very solid, once it moves through the process, you realize, no, that was a pretty raw idea. And when you get a lot of people that want to help you around you, it can be hard because everybody's pushing you in different directions. But they're moving through it, and as a mentor, I'm trying to find a way to help them at that point in time. And you kind of feel proud. You almost feel like a proud dad when they come through the program and you see how much they've changed and evolved in just a short period of time, and you know, how much they're on their way towards that journey of building a company.
So this question is somewhat related to TechStars in a sense that you would have a good handle, because of your entrepreneurial background, on investment trends. So what do you see as the investment trends going into 2016 and 17 and further out?
you know, one of the trends that's happening now, and I think it's just getting stronger, is that in the area of software, I'm talking about here from areas of investment and what's happening there, is that it's because of the tools available and how quickly we can develop software these days, and, you know, access to APIs to pull in things that we've never been able to access quickly before, that the thinking among the investor community is that it's really not that hard for you to get an idea together and go out and test it. I only see that becoming more and more true, that an idea, you know, it's always been a little hard to fund an idea. We certainly heard about investors investing in a PowerPoint, if you will. But those days are pretty much over. And it's not just good enough even to come in with your prototype and say, here's what we're doing, and somebody says, wow, that's fascinating, let's go help you get that out to the market. It is now much more about, what have you built? What proof points do you have on it? What could we build from in terms of the adoption of that product itself? Because it shouldn't have been that hard, too expensive to get it out there and test. So I think that's one of the dynamics, is that the expectation of where you are before you go out and get that investment is higher. Of course, there's a lot of available capital. So once you get over that hurdle, then there's plenty of capital at hand. But, of course, a lot of people are competing for that. The other thing that I'm seeing a bit more focus on is the combination with software as a service in particular, and you know, it doesn't just have to be a SaaS solution, but more focus on the recurring revenue aspect of the innovation and what you're building. So what are people paying for over and over and over, whether it be on a monthly basis, and that could be a consumer who's paying for that, or an enterprise. What is that recurring revenue model underneath your technology, and often referred to as MRR, for monthly recurring revenue? And what's the how big is that number? And just as importantly, how fast is it increasing? So what I've heard more in the last, you know, 12 months has been the focus on MRR and the rate at which that is happening. And that often establishes, if you will, your ticket to have the conversation with the investor to take things to the next level. Again, it proves that your product is sticky, that there's interest, and that you're on to something because it's growing. So those are at the financial side of things that I'm hearing people talk about. At one of the interesting technologies that is getting a lot of attention is the area of bots. Again, I think this brings us back to the whole notion of APIs. But to have something in all of the different areas, whether it be a group chat environment or a system putting out information, to have something listening into that and taking an action, providing some additional information because it's a bot and it's listening, or to actually give the bot commands and have it go do stuff, that is just at the beginning. And I think we're seeing larger companies begin to explore what's possible. Facebook has put some stuff out recently with bots. So the whole idea of bots and connection to machine learning is just coming up. And then I think the other one I see happening is the virtual reality space, and moving beyond just kind of interesting things you could do to, wait a second, there may be quite a market for this. And the technologies that are happening are really the innovation there. There's more view of how that could be commercialized.
So do you have any additional comments on trends with startups specifically?
No. Sorry, Stephen. I think I went into that a bit, and that's what dominates my thinking right now. It's almost hard with so much going on to get my head around it in terms of where the trends are, because it's so accessible. You know, I'm seeing people doing things from growing plants inside so you can have your own private garden that can be managed by your phone so that based on the kind of plant you're growing, it adjusts the lighting and gives you a feeding schedule. You know, it's such a different thing from how am I going to wear virtual reality goggles and stand in front of a room and provide sales training. Again, these are technology things, but the trends are almost hard for me to get my head around because there's so much possibility that I can't see one thing that I consider the trend. I more see entrepreneurship. The interest in entrepreneurship could not be higher. I've never seen it like this before. And we see it in mainstream media, like the popularity of the program Shark Tank. A lot of people believe that because the technology is so accessible and cheap, that there's an opportunity to get in. And because of that, the trend is almost more at that level than it is at the technology level. And I never am able to put my finger on it anything more than, boy, a lot of people are doing things these days.
You know, since we're on this theme of startups and entrepreneurs, I'm going to ask a few more questions in this area, and then we'll change topics. And so, you know, you've been an entrepreneur. You've seen so many entrepreneurs in your work and as a mentor with TechStars. What makes an entrepreneur? What are the attributes of an entrepreneur?
You know, entrepreneurs come in all kinds of different shapes and sizes, right? And so when you try to look through all of that, I believe it is about the passion. Often that is the first answer I hear others give as well, is that you have to believe that you have something that is worth pursuing, especially once you get past the initial fun of the idea. Because being an entrepreneur is really, really hard. And often an entrepreneur is doing it for the first time. That it's certainly a lot of first-time entrepreneurs. And so you get knocked down a lot. You get a lot of people that think, well, gosh, how are you any different than the other guy around the block who does the same thing? Or you go out and you have your great idea and nobody grabs onto it. So you're constantly hit with this, am I on to something that will actually amount to anything else? And in that, when you're questioned, are you by others, or you begin to question yourself, what drives you through that is a deep belief in what you're doing. And it could be about the product, or it could be about the service, or sometimes it's just about yourself and not failing. So maybe a fear of failure seems universal across all entrepreneurs, but that passion that goes with that. And then the other thing that I see is that a lot of the entrepreneurs have partners. Not in all cases. And in fact, I specifically in one business decided to not have a partner. And I'm not sure that was a great idea looking back. But I do see a lot of the entrepreneurs beginning to understand more and more that two or three people coming together as founders, as opposed to that one founder with the idea and then kind of hiring or sort of recruiting in, that more, let's go into this together and let's, you know, take the areas of the business that we're able to do and deepest in, that formation of that team is important. So when I look across entrepreneurs, I'll usually see a good team. I usually see a passion. Often that passion allowing them to drive through a series of failures in the beginning. And sometimes the failures come a little bit later. You know, you get an early momentum and then something big happens. And those sometimes are just as hard. So I see the passion, the quest to be exceptional, the courage to go for it, and having partners tends to be across the spectrum. And some of those entrepreneurs are very technical. They're not people, if you will. And other times you'll see really that charismatic leader. So personality-wise, I haven't seen anything that is universal. But when you put the team together, then you begin to have that well-rounded team. And I have seen that be successful.
And then continuing on with this sort of theme of entrepreneurship and innovation, you know, one of the things that I hear among executives and enterprises is that agility is now key, or having innovation colonies or innovation centers within an enterprise. It's easy to talk about, perhaps hard to do. And you're also, you know, there's this idea of launching products within a enterprise or a service within an enterprise and thinking of it as starting a startup. So do you think there's a startup mentality? And if there is, what are the key steps for successful startups, for enterprises when producing innovations to keep them competitive? Do you see some steps that everybody has to go through, whether they're a startup themselves or an enterprise trying to have that mentality to be competitive?
Yeah, I know a lot of enterprises are, you know, building within the enterprise the startup, if you will. They are a bit different in that there's often a little bit of resources and infrastructure around them. They're not just sort of thrown out into the world to have no support. But the idea that there's something we need to explore and that there's an opportunity and somebody in the company is passionate about it, that is out there, absolutely. And I think it's been out there for a while. You know, maybe it was years ago just called R&D, but now it'd be the kind of internal startup. And when you look at agility as it relates to getting something going, there are some challenges. On the positive side, the concept of agility is that we're going to do something, we're going to learn from that very quickly, we'll take those lessons, we'll evolve it, and we'll keep doing that at a pretty rapid pace in a fairly disciplined way. And so you're kind of bumping along the walls as you go. And that's really effective because usually in the beginning, you have the idea, you have all the possibility, and within a larger company, you have, boy, if this thing works, imagine we have all these customers out there, or we have access to capital. So it can be very romantic in the beginning that you have a great idea and you have all the potential. And the truth is, you look at all the statistics around the emergence of things, whether it be entrepreneurship or within a company, is that the vast majority of them never see the light of day. So to fast fail in the beginning could be the way to find towards the right solution. So you're being agile and kind of bumping along and learning and plowing back that learning in. Or it could simply be, you know, this isn't such a great idea. And let's save some money and let's not pursue something indefinitely, because we never are able to get to a milestone and find that we're on track. So when I think about agile being really the general concept of agility, but let's just say agile, it is breaking things into chunks, deciding and committing to that, and the whole team committing to it, and importantly, not interfering with that team for some short period of time as they pursue it, and then step back, bring all of the constituents together and say, here's what we learned, here's what we've got, and is there any impact based on this last sprint of effort into really our whole view of what we're trying to go at? Or no, you know, that was great. We've got this little bit of success. Okay, what could be the next thing? So the idea of being agile, I have seen work in all kinds of environments. The only thing that is important, in my opinion, about being agile and moving quickly is that the team side. So, and I think a lot of organizations are learning this, is that often teams of three people even are able to move quicker, find things out faster, and adjust, you know, rapidly when they are kept small for as long as possible. Because when you're building something and trying to find your way and you have more people involved with that early on, it becomes hard to balance all of the different trade-offs. And they're all valid. But decision-making and the pursuit of something sometimes is better if it's just laser-focused and going in one direction for a while, and then bringing it in, bringing the kind of the whole picture in and beginning to craft it in another direction. And by it being agile in and of itself, it builds in the system for constituents to always come in and add more as you move down the path. So, yeah, I'm seeing the smaller teams that catching on, that idea of we don't really need, you know, we've always heard that committees don't really build anything. Taking that further into very, very small teams are coming up with some great ideas. And then as it moves, more people can be added on.
Herb, one of the things you talked about is acquiring a CEO in one of your first startups and what that meant. And you yourself, you've been a senior executive in a number of different ventures. So you have this good sense of what makes a great executive. Is there anything you can share in terms of the attributes of a great executive?
Yeah, the executives that I've seen that are able to come in and step into a transition, if you will, so somebody stepping back in my case, there has to be a big focus on the culture, because that organization has a value system. And the value system that has been built up over time under the leader that was in place before the new CEO comes in, is that the values drove systems in the way things are done within the company. The values lead to the systems lead to the behaviors. And, sometimes all of that is pointed in the right direction and it's about taking it to the next level. Other times it's stalled and needs a little bit of a boost, or sometimes things just aren't going that well. The executives that come in that want to truly understand the values and, maybe emphasize some a bit more or bring in just a little bit of new thinking around those value systems are able to take the organization more quickly towards whatever it is that needs to be done, because there's less resistance from the organization. So, if you look at value systems, understanding that, I think that's a big part of the leadership challenge initially. Another part of it goes back to what I said earlier, is truly understanding what's happening in the business. And that takes time. And we do see successful executives come in, and often before any changes are made or new visions are set, there could be several months where they're just meeting and getting in the trenches. And what that does is it builds a bit of respect and credibility so that and ultimately really rapport between the CEO and the other folks in the organization that maybe they didn't know, especially if they came in from the outside. Then when things need to change, there's a sense that, well, they understand what we're doing, so this must be a good change. I trust them. I will say on this question, and why you didn't ask it specifically, I know this can be a little controversial, actually, but I think that the notion of bringing in an outside CEO, whether it be an early stage company that is maybe going to the next level, if you will, and they want to bring in a CEO that has the experience having done this kind of thing before, especially the investors feel comfortable that, hey, here's somebody we know who's worked with before and they have a track record. There's that kind of thing. And then there's the very large companies that are changing and bringing new leadership. I have come from the school, and maybe it goes all the way back to that culture side, is that bringing that from within, that the best leaders are the ones that have the trust and knowledge that they've gained through that trust about the organization. And I happen to come from the school that often an outside CEO isn't necessarily the most effective choice. And that if you go back to entrepreneurs, and I think this is probably true in larger companies, although I don't have this experience, that maybe there's somebody there that doesn't have all of the experience or maybe skill set for that stage of the company, but mentoring the person who in your gut internally is the one that can get it to the next level, the best internal leader, that then instead of bypassing that, instead mentor them, provide access to learning and surround them in different ways than they've been surrounded before to help them take their passion to the next level. Because I assure you that the people in the company that have been driving towards whatever it is, or maybe stalled and frustrated, or had taken a hit as a team. They so deeply want to have that company succeed that that passion and that desire is very powerful.
That's some interesting perspectives. Now we're going to switch directions here, and I'm going to ask the question sort of maybe in two different ways, but really I'm sort of driving at the same kind of theme, and that is, you know, what are some things that continue to excite you? And then I guess looking at it from another perspective, you do so many things, right? You're quite eclectic, you're involved in multiple domains, you've got this great history of success. Well, can you talk about those things that interest you, that you're passionate about?
As you said, there's so many different things I get excited about. I think that can be a good thing and a bad thing at times because you have so many different things you're going at, and trying to find focus can be a challenge for somebody like myself. So when I think about what's driving me today, which would have been, you know, maybe different down the road just because I'll have various different interests, but absolutely today, and I guess, you know, I trust in it going all the way back to being that kid buying that first computer, is that it is so hard to build exceptional software. It is really difficult to get it all right. And when you start adding in all the aspects that make for successful software, whether, you know, not all programs will have a significant user interface on that, but let's just look at that. Just looking at how the whole human-computer interaction space and what's happening there. Add in something like virtual reality, which completely changes the whole way that you're going to interact with things. But even just keeping it down to web technologies or desktop environments, getting that experience right, or specifically, let's talk about mobile. I mean, we have such little real estate to work with. And, you know, now we have three-dimensional kinds of things in terms of pressing into the phone. That space in and of itself is so deep and so hard to get right. Now connect that to all the stuff that's happening on the back end and building software and coming up with good QA strategies, test-driven development, continuous integration, high scalability, big data, APIs, machine learning. So much of this is all integrated now into one product, if not one thing in and of itself often, that it's really hard to get things right and to estimate them. So there's so much focus on estimation when you're doing Agile. So we need to say, okay, how much work can we get done in the next 2 to 3 weeks? Okay, let's grab that because that's our available resources and let's go off and do that. And then at the end of this time, we'll look at where we're at. Well, there's so many dynamics involved with that, and estimation has always been really hard. Now you have the estimation piece that really drives decision-making in a short period of time. And, you know, then you put it out there, and like all software, it tends to run into problems. Now there's environments where that's completely not acceptable to have kind of, you know, dump something out there more in that MVP kind of mentality. But the MVP thinking, the minimally viable product approach, implies that we're going to build something, put it out there, and we're going to take feedback, and then we're going to adjust. So much of this, product strategy, technical expertise, understanding human-computer interaction, on and on, I can't tell you how many times I've just said to myself, holy cow, this is really, really hard for us. We make so many mistakes along the way and say, oh, well, we won't make that mistake again, and we typically don't. And then all of a sudden another one comes up. And when it goes from, hey, let's build this, to it's out there and people are using it, you know, you're into the App Store and people are downloading it and they even found the app. And how did they find the app? Go through all of that. So many different parts of that are challenging. So when I'm, for right now, when I guess, you know, again, who knows what it will be 2 years from now. But what really drives me is how do we build exceptional software? Not just build it and get it out there, but build it in a way that we're very, very proud of it. It will hold up. And everybody kind of says, wow. And it's actually done on time and on budget. Try to do all that. That's a big challenge.
Now, here's a broader question. You know, you've been in the computing field really from being a young person to your full professional life, and even in your side sort of projects or related projects, like, for example, your Domino Awards, it's still related to computing and technology. So I see it as you're involved in every aspect of computing. So because of that, do you think computing should be a recognized profession like medicine or accounting with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and perhaps even recognized credentials?
I think it's an appealing idea right on its surface, because so much of what's happening within technology is, you know, the foundation of really important things happening in this world. So to know that the people behind that piece of technology, you know, have been through some amount of rigor that, you know, says, hey, this is this thing that we're putting out there, you know, I can kind of stand behind it. And I have the credentials to do it, et cetera. That is appealing. I think another part that's appealing is that it's so hard to hire engineers these days, both the scarcity, a lot because of the scarcity, but also because there's so many that are starting to get turned out in a good way. And as such, how do we know how good of a developer you are for whatever that thing that we're tackling? I mean, it could be, you know, not just right out of college. It could be somebody who's, you know, in their late 40s. And so they've got years of experience and they're coming in to do the next thing, but maybe there's been nothing that there's any way to measure them in a concrete way for the last 10, 15 years other than, you know, a little bit of their history in the company. But when you get down into the details of it, what role do they play and are they ready to make an impact? So when you have a certification that then, you know, gives you a way to bucket people a little bit. And it also shows that the individual really took initiative and went out there and got those credentials, just like it would be with a master's program or PhD program. That said, I have to say that when I think about something as significant as licensing or along the lines of like a certified public accountant, those kinds of things, that feels so far from where we are right now that I'm not really sure it applies in this case. Many of the underlying principles are there, but because there's a number of people in the area of technology that would not go through any of that system that are making huge impacts that, you know, a lot of examples there, they didn't even go to college. So to not go to college, but yet end up with some kind of license, that isn't sort of natural in these other systems. So I'm not really a proponent of it, mostly because I can't get my head around how it'd be executed. But having more ways to measure individuals' progress through the learning experience, and knowing that they understand the whole holistic view of what we're tackling, certifications in and of themselves, I think are good things.
I guess there's different aspects of professionalism, though. It's a spectrum. So professionalism means, should you have demonstrated professional development? What I mean by that is you've taken a course or you've self-studied, And then you've got this snapshot of experiences at one point in time. Should you continually evolve that development of your skills through your lifetime? So that's one aspect of what we call professionalism, just maintaining your development. The other one is this idea of a code of ethics. You know, you have this situation with Apple now, you know, sort of fighting the legal system or I guess they're not fighting the legal system, but they're taking a stance. And their engineers could take a stance and say, you know what, for various reasons, we're not going to proceed because from an ethical standpoint, we don't believe we should proceed. I mean, that hypothetically, that could be a stance they take from a code of ethics standpoint, or you have this issue with the, you know, the cars and how there's software being adjusted with respect to cars and things like that. So again, you know, adhering to a code of ethics, that's all this idea of professionalism. And then other aspects are things like taking some responsibility for the work you're doing, having some accountability, ensuring that there's some kind of measure of quality. Those are other aspects or dimension of professionalism. Certification is just one part of it, but doesn't have to be there. Do you see reasons for having some of those other dimensions of professionalism?
I think that's a good distinction. I'm glad you made that. If we look at the ethics piece of it, such an important area right now is privacy, right? And so that is absolutely related to what's going on with Apple. It gets into people hacking cars. To what extent, as an individual, are you comfortable with just sort of for yourself, and what is accepted also in general within industry? Where do you draw the lines of work that, you know, challenges one of the most fundamental aspects of what are essentially our country is founded on? And then even taking that further into, you know, what's how we're all connected in a world. So if I look at ethics and I look at an area like privacy, I'm not sure where the line gets drawn on any of that. I think that's kind of the nature of ethics. But a focus on it and a training, discussion, absolutely. You know, I think there's much more that can be done there in terms of what am I doing and what impact could that have? And that's just one piece of it, right? But if you go into all that's going on with in terms of people breaking into systems and security issues, is there an ethic involved in the work I'm doing that would then say I am working in a way that will protect the infrastructure, the assets of the organization I'm working for? I mean, some of that's taken care of in terms of the employee contracts, but conversation about what am I doing and its impact on the security and the vulnerability of what I'm working on. Again, I see that. So I believe it's a very hard question and or area. It's an area that is important, but when you get down to whether there should be a recognition within the industry, I don't know how that's done in a way that fits with how complex and how dynamic things are right now. And, you know, things around standing behind the quality, you know, an accountant can sign off on something, right, and then they've stood behind it. They've put their firm on the line and their license on the line. Well, in software, quality could be managed by 200 people downstream from what you're working on. So, you know, there were quality, many, many more quality checks than might go into, you know, a particular thing like medicine or accounting. So for me, I guess maybe it's just too big and complicated that I can't get myself to say, yes, we absolutely should be doing this. More education on these topics, I'm definitely behind.
Herb, we're down to our last question. You know, you're a notable figure. You've had this amazing career. You're making historical, substantive contributions to the world, to the profession, to students, to education, to entrepreneurship, in so many different areas. It's just a remarkable career. In fact, a remarkable family. I know your wife is making just significant contributions as well. So, you know, from all of this work that you've done, from all of the speaking and travels, do you have any interesting stories to share? Maybe something amusing that happened to you or just totally surprised you, or something that was really unexpected, or you just went, wow, that's really cool. Maybe something that was really amazing.
I've been so fortunate to have different experiences of all different nature, as you said. And, you know, it's kind of like being asked, you know, what's your favorite song or band or movie? And it stumps you when you get a question like that. When I think about the business side of things, and a memory pops into my head. It was my trip to India. And what really stood out on that trip is that I was invited to tour a data center of a company in Bangalore. And it was kind of a big deal. They were very honored to have me there. And I was welcomed, and I was walked through, and I was given the tour, and it was going to culminate in getting to see the machine room, if you will. And so we go through it all, and we get back, and we go in, and I'm in something half the size of my home office. There are racks, and the computers are in the racks, and the cables are flying everywhere. And there's a big thing blowing air out with a fan, and it's a very compressed space. And I looked at this, and I just envisioned the data center here in the United States, where every cable should be labeled and tie-wrapped and put into its place. And, you know, the cooling system, you know, feels like North Pole. And I went, wow, this is what they're using to get the job done. They're proud of this because it works. And from the business side, it made such an impact on me that sometimes we don't need everything we think we need in order to be successful. And I think in India, you come across that in many different ways. It's the practical use of what is available to you, and that often things that don't look like they might be, you know, good enough from one perspective are actually very good and the pride of other folks. And it kind of brought me back from thinking everything needed to be just the greatest, highest end stuff, and come back to what is the utility and what are we trying to accomplish. So that had a big business impact. I think in terms of any other general story of my experiences, I will just share one great thing we do, is that every 3 years, my wife and I take our two children on a big trip, and we actually split the kids up. So every 3 years, I'm with my daughter. The next 3 years, I'm with my son. And we've been doing this since a young age. And maybe some of my favorite memories are, you know, going around in Japan with my six-year-old daughter and her going, holy cow. And, you know, going to Alaska with my son and having that one-on-one time. So it maybe wasn't a specific event. It was maybe it's who you're with and all the different little adventures that happen along the way. And to have that opportunity to do that with both my kids back and forth, and we've been all over the world. So that's the kind of thing I think about most when I think about my travel. It's the time I was with those kids. And, of course, I have to say, I had an absolutely wonderful trip with just my wife. Last year, we went to Italy. So it's not that my wife and I don't travel together. I think it's just sometimes bringing and opening the eyes to children and having that one-on-one time was just very unique and special and great memories for our whole family.
Well, that was a great story, or stories, I should say, that you shared. And it adds this additional dimension to you and all the work that you do and all the contributions you make. I know you're really busy and you have many demands on your schedule because of all the different aspects you have in your life. So thank you for coming in today and sharing so many of your experiences with our audience.
So it's my pleasure, Stephen. You inspire me. You've done such great things and brought a lot of people together and putting out this information. And so I'm more than happy to spend this time with you. And I appreciate you setting up and making it available.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Herb Morelli, top innovating chairman, CEO, and CTO, who shares so many of his best practices, lessons, and tips.